Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Bells are ringing this week at the Alberta Research Council for three Alberta scientists who are now Nobel laureates. They contributed, along with other scientists around the globe, to a UN report on what we must do to rein in the impact of climate change. And underground storage of carbon dioxide is something Alberta pioneered. And on the social front, heritage researcher Dr. Catherine Worthington looks at the issues street youth face when trying to access health services. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's kind of a special day here today at the Alberta Research Council. I'm John McDougall, the CEO, as you know, or many of you know. As all of you are aware who work at ARC, we started a tradition some time ago of trying to celebrate special events with what we call a bell ringing. And many of you will certainly know that the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change jointly with Al Gore of the USA. I won't comment on Al Gore, but I will comment on the international panel. Working Group 3 of that panel was involved with mitigation, and among the work that they completed was a major report on CO2 capture and storage. And I suspect, you know, seeing the people sitting here and so on, you can anticipate where I'm going with this little story. Two of the leading contributors to that work were our own Bill Gunter, ARC Distinguished Scientist, and Stephen Batchew, former ARC employee, now with the Alberta Geological Survey, both of whom played significant roles as lead authors of that report. So we're really quite excited. What we're really here, though, to do is not to listen to me, but to celebrate these two fine gentlemen. So, Bill, we want to thank you, and Stefan, you as well, for your incredible commitments to this field of work, acknowledge you as our first Nobel laureates, and on behalf of ARC, extend our congratulations. And with that, I'd like you to ring the bell, and then I'd like you to say a few words. And if you could each do it, this would be great. So, congratulations.
How about it, Bill?
Well, this bell is actually the biggest bell I've ever rung. It used to be a dinner bell my mother used to ring when she wanted me to come.
That was John McDougall, President and CEO of the Alberta Research Council. And I had a chance to ask him about the bell that hangs in the foyer at ARC.
Well, actually, when I came to ARC, one of the things that I felt we needed was something where we could get together and celebrate with each other. And not too long after that, I ended up at a charity auction, and my wife and I purchased this bell, and we thought that it might be useful to put in here and turn it into a bit of a celebratory device for ARC, and we've been ringing it ever since.
What kind of bell is it? It's awfully big.
Well, it's off an old steam locomotive that it's about 90 years old, but this was the engine that came through Edmonton in the sort of the 1920s era when ARC was founded.
Today the bell was rung, and it's a pretty exciting event. Could you tell me more?
We were saying it's almost funny that we're ringing a bell for a Nobel, but we have two of our... One a former and one a present ARC employee who've been very active with the international panel on climate change work. And their work was related to CO2 sequestration and mitigation. And, of course, that group was named as a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize this year. So a pretty exciting event for us.
When you look at the carbon sequestration research that has gone on here, What part does that play in sort of what's going on around the world as we try to tackle this climate change problem?
Well, it's interesting that Bill Gunter, the ARC employee that was recognized, and Stefan Batchew from the Alberta Geological Survey as well, have been traveling the world, really, as a result of their knowledge and expertise. So they're in South America, they're in Australia, they're in China, they're in Europe, and everybody is basically picking their brains to try to see how we can collectively deal with this problem more effectively. So they're really acknowledged as world experts.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay, it's great talking to you again.
That was John McDougall, President and CEO of the Alberta Research Council. The Nobel Prize-winning report of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change included chapters from its three working groups. One deals with climate change science, another with adaptation, and the third with mitigation. Dr. Bill Gunter belongs to the third working group. An ARC distinguished scientist, Bill is a pioneer in developing the technology for the underground storage of carbon dioxide.
I was connected on the storage side of carbon capture and storage. The capture side was handled by other experts. And we look specifically at storage in depleted oil and gas reservoirs, in coal beds, and in aquifers. And as I mentioned earlier, we had actually written a book on aquifer storage of CO2 and published in 1996 before this really got underway. And at the time, there was no interest in storing CO2. They just wanted to understand where the basin had the storage capacity. And so I got into coal bed methane, looking at ways of enhancing coal bed methane using CO2, and the CO2 remained behind, so it offered an opportunity to help our declining gas reserves, and at the same time offered a means to get rid of CO2. And today, as any technology, it takes a long time to commercialize. It still hasn't been commercialized, and we're still working on it, but we still think it has a lot of promise. So probably those two aspects were where my major contributions were.
So there's a little bit of irony in there, because your report was published in 1996, and then you went off in a little bit of a different direction, and then the work that was published by the IPCC in 2006 is the one that got the Nobel Prize.
Well, yeah, and I think it's on a different level. Our report, of course, was by probably four or five Alberta scientists. It was published by an Alberta publishing company. And at the time, there wasn't the uptake that there would be today. So, you know, it's, I don't say this sarcastically, but it's a matter of timing. And I also think that obviously the IPCC report is, much more global in nature because of the people involved from all over the world.
And Al Gore's name keeps coming up. Now, what is his role in this?
Well, Al Gore is our publicist. He actually has taken it to another level. The IPCC work is, when it's released, it's read by scientists. There's also a summary for politicians. But on the whole, it gets a brief blurb in the page in the newspaper that's released, and that's the end of it. Whereas with Al Gore's, he chose to take the media as a movie, which actually is probably making money, to release this. And the fact that he's talking about a serious issue in the world and making money at the same time on it is a phenomenal. And it's something that we couldn't do. So I think basically, because of his background and his fame, that he's an ideal person to actually popularize this. Whereas, if you take scientists like us, we really don't have the platform to get that much attention.
What is the potential for this in the future?
Well, it's huge, because the climate, even the Kyoto requirements are minuscule compared to what the long-term emissions reductions that are needed. And so what's been popular is a thing called the wedge concept, where you take a technology and you decide on how much CO2 it could be responsible for reducing over a period of time. which is the wedge. In any scenario, carbon capture and storage is a significant wedge in the solution to reach the final emission reductions.
Is this something that every country could use?
Every country could use in the sense that CO2 doesn't, a molecule of CO2 can travel the world. It's not, no country owns it. So if we reduce emissions in Alberta, that's going to affect the global CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. And so it doesn't matter so much where it's done. It's where it's done, you know, best and where it's done most inexpensively. So in that sense, Alberta is one of the places in the world where this technology, because of our oil and gas industry and the huge Alberta basin, where it makes a lot of sense to do it on an international scale.
Is this going to play into our expansion or, of the oil sands deposits?
Oh, definitely. The most expensive part of carbon capture and storage is the capture part. And basically because up to the current time, our biggest emitters have been coal-fired power plants. And they produce a dilute stream of CO2, 13% CO2. But the oil sand upgrading plants also produce CO2 and are rapidly reaching the scale of our coal-fired power plants, but they produce a pure CO2 stream, so it's cheaper to capture. So actually, in terms of lowering emissions, oil sands offers an opportunity for a better opportunity than the coal plants for carbon capture and storage.
Thank you very much, Bill, and congratulations.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Bill Gunter, principal scientist in carbon capture and storage at the Alberta Research Council, and now he's a Nobel laureate. Also on hand for the celebration at the Alberta Research Council was Dr. Stéphane Batchu, now a senior advisor to the Geological Survey of Alberta and the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board. Stéphane also worked at ARC with Dr. Bill Gunter on carbon storage technology. Stéphane's contribution to the Nobel Prize-winning report on climate change included estimating the capacity of geological media to store carbon dioxide. He believes the technology has great potential.
Yes, it is, and particularly in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and northeastern British Columbia, in the sense that carbon dioxide can be and actually is captured in certain instances from large emitters, depending also on the purity of the CO2 stream. And then once it's been captured, can be transported by pipeline to a storage site, and then it can be injected into the ground where hopefully it will stay for thousands to millions of years. The technology exists today. It has been employed in enhanced oil recovery, even in Alberta at Joffre in the past and for more than 20 years now, and also in Saskatchewan at Weyburn. In the United States, more than 90 such operations in West Texas. So the technology exists. To do it on the scale needed for climate change mitigation, it has to be done on a scale that is several orders of magnitude larger than the current operations. Instead of million or 2 million tons a year, like current operations do, it has to be in the order of billions of tons a year. And that's a target that it's hoped for to be achieved by 2030-2050. So the main issues are not so much the technology itself, but the lack of financial drivers to do it, because this is a cost to the industry, and the lack of a legal and regulatory regime framework that will take care of this new emerging industry. And there are various organizations that are working on this. And I would add that, for example, G8, the Group of Eight, 2 years ago instructed the International Energy Agency and the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum, of which the latter I represent Canada on, instructed to come up with recommendations by the next meeting next year in Hokkaido in Japan. And we had a number of meetings already on this subject, two meetings, one in San Francisco in 2006, one in Oslo in June 2007, and there is a last coming one actually in Calgary in November 2007, this 3 weeks away, where the recommendations will be finalized and then they will go to the G8 leaders for consideration, and this deals particularly with carbon capture and storage, and the focus is mostly on non-technology in the sense that it addresses legal and regulatory frameworks, public education and acceptance of the new technology, intellectual property, transfer of rights, and so on, and financial incentive to move the technology forward. And these are basically the main barriers to large-scale deployment rather than technology per se. That's not to say that there is no need to improve the technology, and there are certain aspects that need to be worked on, but by and large, we can do it. We know how to do it.
What does it mean to you being recognized in this way?
Well, to tell you the truth, at the beginning, I really didn't realize it. I read in the newspaper that the Nobel Prize was awarded to Al Gore and to the IPCC, and then when somebody asked me, yeah, does it make you a Nobel laureate, I thought for a second and said, yeah, probably yes. But the significance really dawned on me when 2 weeks ago I was at a meeting in Brazil, in South America, and as it happened, among the participants was another colleague of mine, and Bills, that got the same honor. And when people found out that we are there in the audience, they really lined up to have their pictures taken with us. And, you know, we had a standing ovation, and only then really dawned on me that, hey, this is something. This is not something to dismiss easily and so on. And even now I'm not exactly fully... It didn't really sink in. That is, even getting this request to come and join join Bill here at ARC, it's another add-on to make me realize the importance of this.
Congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Stéphane Batchu, Senior Geoscience Advisor with the Geological Survey of Alberta and the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board. He's also now a Nobel laureate for his work on climate change, along with Dr. Bill Gunter of the Alberta Research Council and Dr. David Keith at the University of Calgary. They contributed a chapter to the Nobel Prize-winning report published by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The Nobel Prize ceremonies will be held in Sweden on December 11th. When it comes to preventing the spread of HIV, not everybody is taking advantage of the services that are available in the community to help them. Understanding what barriers stand in their way is the research focus of Dr. Catherine Worthington. Catherine is an associate professor in the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Calgary. She's also a population health researcher with the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. I recently attended a breakfast talk that Catherine gave to the Calgary Petroleum Club about one very high-risk and vulnerable population, our street youth.
When you think about street-involved youth and the environments that they're exposed to, we have to look at everything from their childhoods and the risks they were exposed to, both socially, physically, sometimes sexually. Again, a large proportion of street-involved youth have had rough home backgrounds and have been exposed to either physical abuse, emotional abuse or neglect, and right on through to sexual abuse. So we have to look at their backgrounds and what they've been exposed to as children. We have to look at their school experiences. And then we move on through to their exposure to risks on the street. So things like violence on the street, not having a place to stay, not having clean facilities to wash up in. So it's the basic survival needs that street youth, when they're living on the street, have to contend with. Then again, there are a host of issues that come up when you're adapting to life on the street, things like drug use, being involved in the sex trade, and just generally negotiating with others on the street to get by, which can sometimes involve health and physical risks.
Now, obviously, they're going to need services. Do they take advantage of the services, the health services, or is there a problem in them getting together between, say, the youth in trouble and doctors who can help them?
We found that over two-thirds of them were actually accessing services. It was only about 15% who hadn't accessed any street services over the past 3 months. So they're fairly well connected to particular types of services, the outreach van, the health clinic at 8th and 8th, services which feel friendly and which are approachable by youth who may not have a health card or who may not have photo ID if they've run away from a placement or a home. So they're using services selectively. I guess the question is whether they're getting enough and enough kinds of services. And I think one of the other things we found when we took our results to our community roundtable was the answer is probably not. We could do a lot more in terms of prevention services, supports as youth start to encounter problems through the educational system, alcohol and drug use, experiences of violence. Just more upfront work so that youth don't end up living on the street for extended periods of time.
If services are there and the kids seem to be, pretty in tune with how to get them, where's the gap then? What's the concern?
Well, again, the concerns that we heard expressed were more around, and again, this is typical of all youth, not just street-involved youth, they were more around the rules, the regulations, the restrictions, the requirements that many programs had. These youth aren't necessarily living on a 9-to-5 clock, and oftentimes find that restrictions in terms of service hours, things like curfews, restrictions in terms of even simple things like not being allowed out of a building for 5 minutes because you have a counselor coming to meet with you, and you want to run out and buy a pop or something. These things youth found were very restrictive and in some cases disrespectful of them as individuals. From a broader services perspective, I think what we also heard were that youth often have difficulty navigating the maze, and that can be as something as simple as not having a bus token to get from the shelter that you're living at to the educational program which you're attending, right on through to difficulty meeting up with a counselor or social worker as frequently as you would like in order to provide service when you need it rather than according to an agency's mandate. Again, these aren't concerns that we don't all have when we're dealing with bureaucracies. I think, though, that the place that these youth happen to be in, particularly when they're living on the street, is just that much more augmented because they don't have the typical supports. Again, even something as simple as getting from point A to point B when you might have to jump the C train without a ticket in order to get there becomes a barrier to services. And we heard about that a lot.
You've also been doing a fair bit of work with AIDS and HIV concerns. Mm-hmm. So how do you tie that into the situation that you find street youth in today?
Well, and in fact, the focus of my work for about the past 10 years has been HIV services development. But it's really hard to disentangle that from other social and health issues because many of the populations who are at highest risk for HIV are also those who are vulnerable to other health risks. So in the case of street-involved youth, they are a group at higher risk of HIV because of some of the activities that they have to undertake to survive on the street. And like most youth, condom usage is not high, so that they're just generally at higher risk for sexually transmitted infections like HIV. When you're working with a population like street-involved youth, you, again, as I've said before, have to take into context their whole environment. So everything from their social situation and social networks, the way that the culture works, the way that street dynamics play out, spirituality, the health and social services networks, and again, all of the risks that they've experienced prior to life on the street, things like their educational experience, their family background, and so on. And so it's very hard to disentangle one set of service needs from the other because these are high-risk kids with multiple needs. So everything from physical, mental, right on through to social, familial, and emotional support.
Kathy, one of the ways that you conduct your research, it's a little bit different than someone who's working in a lab. Your lab is actually the people out there in the street. How does that work? What's it called?
Well, the label it's usually given is called community-based research. And what that really means is community-owned research, the way we interpret it. So again, as social work researchers and social workers, we're very comfortable working with those in the community around community development and around issues of concern to them. So we use fairly rigorous research methodologies. We don't skimp on the way we do the research, but we make sure that we involve community at every step of the research process, right from research question formulation and study design on through to actually, you know, developing survey questions or questions we're going to ask interview participants, and right on through the back end, that important piece where agencies and community representatives see the results and can start to use the results in their own programs and services. So it's community-based research because it's really a partnership between academic researchers and community members.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Catherine Worthington, an associate professor in the Faculty of Social Work at the University of Calgary and a population health researcher with the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, ICORD, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Genome Alberta, the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.